And now,
Capital 263.
Welcome to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
And I'm Tawanda Henry Beatty. And yeah, welcome to the best political podcast in the country. Chris and I are making podcasts great again. Make podcasts great again.
Wow. Yes, that's what we're doing.
Make ZANU Primary is great again. Bring back Kasukweri.
Get out of here. This Tuna hot take Tuna Matema Danda. Matema Danda pa komiza. Matema Danda.
Mutara zvinzvekumba kwenyu kana kuti zvinzvekupati kwenyu.
Zvinzvekupati ka. No, zvinzvekupati tina rugeje. And we stand by our men. We stand by what the party has led us to do. Yeah, obviously today, what's the date today? Today is the 4th of May. May the 4th be with you. We shall be speaking about my primary elections that just finished. Continuation of last week's conversation, pretty much.
With results now.
Yeah, with results. Also going to talk about...
You there?
Yeah, we just went... Oh, yes, we're going to talk about Themba Mliswa.
Themba Mliswa and Rueneko, that interview, or just Themba Mliswa in general and his crusade against corruption.
Yep, and then...
Comrade Nelson Wamba Diawamba Chamisa and his xenophobic comments.
Yes.
And maybe a little bit of some philosophical... some pedestrian opinions on alternative government formations is maybe what we can say.
I don't think it was pedestrian. I thought it was, you know.
I mean, our takes are going to be
pedestrian. Oh, our takes. Yes. As
our takes as Jonathan Moore said, we are pedestrian.
As good professor said.
Yes. So.
Right. So let's get into it. Primary elections. ZANU-PF did the thing. It did the thing in a very messy way. Elections were supposed to be on Sunday. They ended up being on Monday in some places. I think even running into Tuesday in others. And that was because really it was, you know, the ballot papers weren't there on time. Some people's names were missing from ballot papers. It was very disorganized. And I think one of the excuses that was given, or the reasons that was given for that by Rugeje, was that they had a problem with the printers.
But the thing is, Fidelity Printers is owned by ZANU-PF, isn't it?
I didn't even know if they were printing at Fidelity, but Fidelity Printers, isn't that the one?
Fidelity is owned. Isn't Fidelity owned by ZANU-PF?
I'm not sure. Isn't Fidelity the one that deals with gold?
Yeah, but they've also got printers, don't they? Ameno.
Yeah, well, it's a printing and gold refinery company owned by the Reserve Bank. No, it's owned by the Reserve Bank.
Oh, okay. So which is the ZANU one? Jongwe Printers.
Jongwe Printers, yes.
Yeah, sorry. Thanks for pulling me out there.
Yeah, so... Jongwe Printers, they had a problem with their printers and they couldn't print all the information on time. And one thing that, you know, I then thought is, well, for their primaries, they could have spread it out over the week anyway. And then
just like what the MPC is doing?
And then just had, you know, different provinces in different days. Because 3,000 candidates for 210 seats, that's a lot of people to manage. And the process was going to be very difficult. And evidently, that's what happened. And so there were issues on the day and post-election. Some people are not happy. Some people say that the process was not free and fair. The use of police has been brought into into question.
Let's try and link it from sort of last week. I think we spent a lot of time focusing on Koromonzi South. So just to give you some of the results quickly that people would be interested in. Koromonzi South, yeah. That's the one that we had pitted James Makamba versus Godfrey Ningamu.
Mount Darwin South.
Sorry.
Yeah, Mount Darwin South.
And that was won by Mr. Kabonzo. So one of the 20 contestants, one person we didn't even mention, beat out both James Makamba and Godfrey Tenengamu on the ground.
Yes, and Kabonzo.
Kabonzo.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been calling him Kabonzo this whole time. I think I'm racist.
To be fair, it could be because this list has misspelled names. So Ozias Budeo for one is spelled obvious, which is interesting.
Because he's obviously a criminal.
Wow.
But that's those. I suppose Ozias Budeo won in his constituency.
Yeah, but
and then. Just going through the list, I'm just trying to pick out, the full list is available online for anyone that's really interested to see, you know, where particular. I'm just trying to find the big ones. Obviously, Cormac Chris Mswanga lost in Norton.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Mshowe as well lost, I think.
Yes, Mshowe lost.
Nyasha Chikwinya lost as well.
Mm-hmm.
Of the fake news people thought. Paul Mangwana lost, of course. And then some of the fake news, so not fake news, but some of the confusion that happened. The Chinamasa that lost was actually Anthony Tindai Chinamasa, who the Herald claim is his son, but who I've actually heard is his nephew, Patrick's nephew. I'm not too sure. And then. Comrade Obam Chinguri also won the women's proportional seat. They had only released one set of, I suppose, one ward's results as opposed to all three. So she made it through. Harare South, I'm confused with Harare South. Did Tonga Manalanga go win?
Yeah, so this is another one of those contentious ones where Harare South. So yesterday was Thursday. There were demonstrations at ZANU-PF headquarters over Tongai Mnangagwa winning Harare South because the people felt that Douglas Mahia should have won that seat. He was announced as the winner, and it's one of these controversial ones where, you know, the people in the video were saying Ah Tongai Atimzi and Kanasiriso Taku Poram Sango, Takuita Poram Sango, Oto Fotera Chamisa. I said long ago that they shouldn't, the Mnangagwas shouldn't have run outside of Emerson himself. There was no need for any of that because we've come from this situation of dynastial politics, an issue where within ZANU-PF of creating a dynasty, and now it's just going to come up once again.
So Tunga is definitely one of the sons.
I have no idea. It's easy to draw them together, even if he's a nephew or a cousin or whatever it is. Just by the fact that they have the same last name, it's going to be an issue. And there was no need for ZANU-PF to do it now. 2023, you can bring in as many of the family members as you want, but at this stage, because of how controversial the Mugabes were, it wasn't necessary, I don't think. And I don't know how this Mahia situation will play out, especially in Harare South. I think Harare is one of those areas where ZANU-PF has always struggled. And it's likely to happen again, especially now in those areas and with these things going on. But there's been a lot of controversy over these primary elections, and it seems right now that there's about to be a standoff between the open quotes junta and the war veterans. And when I say the war veterans, I mean those led by Chris Mtswangwa. Because he does have pull there, and he lost, and he says that there was the use of police, and
so before we get into that, as an overall thing, you know, last week we had sort of said it was an opportunity. We had sort of said it was an opportunity for the party to reform itself. Yes. And also we had sort of said it was really a combination of whether the elites versus the regular party, you know, because what do you think actually happened there? Because like someone like Chris Mtsongo winning shows that the losing, sorry, shows that the party is actually renewing itself. Because the guy that beat him out, he's a newcomer. I've never heard of him before.
Yeah, I think in some places, you know, I think it's mixed. I think in some places it's the people who just decided that this is who we want. We're tired of, you know, some of these old people who've done nothing for us, and you know it's. I can understand people being tired of certain names, of seeing certain names on the ballot, and just saying, you know what, let's try new people as well. In terms of which way, I'm not sure who all of the people on the list are. So I can't pinpoint and say, oh, well, this person is, you know, of the elites, or this person is of the old school. But I think that it's the start of some sort of renewal. You do have new candidates on the list. I mean, you have the likes of Sekai Nzenza. She's one. Dr. Sekai Nzenza. She writes for the Herald. There's some other names that I want to pull up. Just give me a second. Manicaland province. You have Jephthah Sakupanya in Mutasa Central. He's worked in the water and sanitation field for...
Yeah, I heard he's quite well regarded, didn't he? Dr. Sakupanya, I've heard he's really well regarded.
So he's worked in water and sanitation for you know, different NGOs. I think he's on the board of Zinwa as well. You have Mishek Mataranyika, who I believe is a lawyer, and he's also related to the
Philip Mataranyika,
yes, of
Nyaradzo.
Nyaradzo. So you have new people coming, professionals.
And big, sir.
So you have these new professionals.
big Rapinza.
You have people.
I don't know, if the Mataranyikas are getting into politics, people must actually be scared. Because if they wanted to, they could actually make people see fire.
Well, first they have to win. But I think, you see, I think it's moving away from making people see fire to saying, well, you know what, let's actually get involved. Let's actually work to make this better for us, also for our businesses. So you do have that elites aspect to it, but you also have professionals and a bit of change in certain places. And I'm not saying it's the entire list. I haven't gone through it. And
talking about what does.
But I think I was just going to say that I think it is the start of a change, especially where you see, and I honestly believe that, you know, Mtsangwa just wasn't for the people, and the people just didn't want him. This whole yes, the police aspect, you know, comes into it, and yes, there was the use of state resources, and ZANU-PF must own up to it. I mean, Emerson likes to say, that's his go-to. Even during the factionalism days, whenever he was called out, he would always, you know, say, come out and say, well, this is wrong, I have nothing to do with it. But somebody had something to do with it, and whoever those people are, they must be brought forward and said, you know what, you did this and this is wrong. And it was ironic, actually, that Mtsangwa came out with a government-issued letterhead and, you know, assistant to the president, but he's calling out practices in ZANU-PF, where he's writing to the ZANU-PF commissar. You're bringing your official office into party issues. If he doesn't spot the irony on that, then what he's doing is, you know, hypocritical.
It's doubly ironic, because he's complaining about the use of the ZRP as state resources being abused for party issues while he's doing the same thing.
Exact same thing. So And I honestly believe that he was beaten fair and square. I mean, you know, obviously there are discrepancies, but I just think that in certain places, people just are tired of these old faces and they really want, you know, some sort of renewal. Also considering the fact that, you know, people in Norton have been dealing with Temba as their candidate for a while. Oh, shout out to Temba's sister.
Oh, yes, Temba's sister, yes.
She also won.
Auntie Mary, she won in Urungwe.
In Urungwe, yes.
Urungwe West.
Keith Guja.
Yeah, but Keith hasn't been in that constituency since he won the election in 2015.
I'm not surprised, you see. Which is, you know, Mchangwa narrowly won. Was it narrow, the 2013 victory?
He won by 1,200 votes.
Yeah, it was a narrow victory.
And then he had previously lost in 2008. So it was a very narrow victory by any standards, to be fair.
And him being rejected by the people, I honestly believe it was by the people. Maybe we'll find evidence otherwise.
This goes back into the question that has been at play for a while, even before the primaries. The question of the war vets,
yeah,
and the influence that they still hold. The war vets were sidelined by G40, and some see that was the problem. That's why G40 failed. And when the coup, not a coup, happened, we saw, you know, Chris Musangwe at the forefront of being the media team, I suppose. Let me say that the media facing team, international media facing team, who controlled the narrative in South Africa of what was happening. But it's sort of becoming evident, Kuti, they weren't necessarily in control or even knew what was happening, because now they're being sidelined by junta-facing or junta-esque candidates, in terms of you haven't seen Rugege protect them as much as you would have expected.
Yeah, I mean, it's which is why I said that, you know, it looks like there's about to be a standoff between the junta and the war vets. And I think it's unfortunate that it has come to this, but the war vets do have a high level of entitlement. And at some point, certain people need to realize that they're just not as popular as they think they are. And it's articulating that there is still space for people outside, or there's still space for them to have an impact outside of official office, and I think this is where we fall short. That there's still things for people to do in the country without actually holding one particular political office. But
isn't we said that these primary elections were like Zhivuta? So the war vets, particularly the ones that who helped push the Lacoste agenda, were looking to eat.
And I think they can still eat. I think, you know, within ZANU-PF itself, they, you know, if they reorganize, ZANU-PF can be, or they can find position and influence within the party itself, or, you know, within other aspects of civil society, that they can grow spaces within other aspects of civil society. But I don't see a need for Mchangwa or, you know, any of the other people that are complaining to actually hold certain seats. They just need to come to terms with the fact that, you know, they are from the old school first and foremost. And I genuinely also believe that they're disconnected from understanding the needs of their constituents, which is why their constituents just don't want them. And obviously, the issue that is being faced here is an entitlement issue. And they feel entitled because they, you know, they supported the coup, not a coup. But at the same time, if I look at the junta side to it, aside from them also feeling entitled, I also think that they work with efficiency and they work with the best, or they want to work with the best for the best possible outcome for ZANU-PF itself. As disorganized as the process was, it can, I don't think they have an intention to further destabilize the party. And I think it was a disorganization of the primary polls, but not an imposition of candidates that took place. I don't see them.
You don't think that there was an imposition of candidates? No, you think the opposite happened?
Well, my thing is, why would they deliberately move against Mutsangwa?
That's an interesting one.
Especially for a relatively unknown individual.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, this unknown individual who ran, Roni, I'm forgetting his last name, is the same person who ran against in the by-election against Themba Mlisu and lost then as well. So it's not like he hasn't been on the ground, and it's not like there's not evidence of that happening.
Yeah.
I think, look, the process was messy and it was hilarious. You know, there's to see from an opposition perspective in terms of there's lots of jokes that have come up, but at the end of the day, you know, running a mock election in every constituency and every ward in the country is a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
And while they've had 50 or 37 years or 40 or 38 years of experience to do it, and then we expect them to have run it better, we can't deny that just the fact that it happened in most instances is incredibly impressive.
And so
the people who are, you know, that's my only thing. The people who are saying, look, ZANU paid up because of the way the elections were shambolic, that's premature and it's almost naive to the point. It's naive. And I think a lot of actual ZANU-PF people, you know, will even push that narrative that we're more disorganized than we really are to sort of allow some pedestrian analysis into some false sense of security. Good, ZANU-PF is disorganized. They have their problems, yeah, but I don't think that was a sign of them being in trouble.
But you see, and another thing is that as much as, you know, there was disorganization, it is a few contentious seats that suffered. It's not the entire process. So you had 210 seats, and out of them, some of them still had issues, but it's, you know, we can say that maybe 20 out of those 210 where there were serious problems, you know. The rest people are going to take. There are no issues. The rest people are going to say, oh, well, these are the candidates that have been elected and this is how we are going with it. I think you can even narrow it down to maybe 10 real serious issues. If you think of the Harare South, if you think of Mount Darwin South was one of them, if you think of Norton as another one, you know, but the rest, everyone is going to say this process was free and fair as far as we're concerned. So, yeah. But we'll obviously focus on these few.
But also a process being declared free and fair is generally to do with the candidates. For example, Paul Mangwana said that he will accept his loss even though he doesn't think the process was run free and fair. If he kicks up a stink, then it becomes more of an issue,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, that is primary elections in ZANU-PF. I'm just trying to see if we've really missed out anything particularly bad.
Actually, ZANU-PF launches its manifesto today. So I think this is all going to blow over in terms of the primary election issue. I don't know what Mutsangwa is going to do. I think he's the major headache that is possible. But outside of that, I think, you know, it's going to be business as usual. We already see that they've started their campaign. The billboards are up and they are massive and they are going all sorts of places with ED's face on them. And it's now them, you know, kicking into gear. And I think as now that they've made the decision to start, they're going to close ranks and say, listen, we will deal with all the internal issues, but now our primary focus is winning this election. So let's, you know, solidify. There's still, you know, ED still has those five, or whoever wins has the option to elect five people to government outside of who are not parliamentarians, and some of those people very well could be Anamtuangwa to appease them at the end of the day. So there's still room for negotiation and for them to sort out their mess in some way.
Some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see how that manifesto launch goes, to see whether there's anything particularly new. And if there is, maybe we'll bring you a supplementary episode. Moving on to, we said we'd speak about
Temba,
Honorable Maliswa, and the headaches he's causing for the corrupt people in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, Temba's been on a rampage. He had an interview on Capitalk this week.
On Capitalk on Wednesday night, yeah. With Ruweneko Parenyatwa.
And he was discussing corruption with Ozias Bute.
Yeah, because previously, for those that don't know, I think Ozias Bute had been on Capitalk with Ruweneko, and Ruweneko had posed questions to him about the allegations that he's corrupt and his links. Not allegations. She had simply posted the facts of how he's constantly being rewarded by Super, of how his time at Zim Cricket was, you know, led to the downturn and probably the worst period of Zimbabwe cricket, how in being on the board of Metbank, as well as being on the, I think, chair of being involved in Potras, and then Potras depositing money in Metbank, all these things that he's actually involved in, that at the very least abrogation of his fiduciary duties, and at the very most outright corrupt. So she posted these questions, a lot of these questions coming from Temba Mliswa, and then he then decided to respond to that by saying that Temba Mliswa actually borrowed money from me. He said he extorted money from me, and I thought he was a friend, but obviously when someone owes you money, they start going after your person. And I suppose this interview with Ruweneko was then Honorable Maliswa's chance to respond.
And respond he did.
Did. He responded. First of all, I want to say that I think Temba is a master of viral and strategic marketing. Maybe I think that's what he's good at.
He kicked up a storm in the studio. So he came out and he, you know, repeated all these allegations against Pute and against Super in terms of corruption, in terms of, you know, them buying shares in Telecel. And his complaints that there are corporate governance issues in Potras being shareholders in some of these institutions when they are also the regulator. He cited Super and Ozias as being leaders of this mafia, if we can call it that. And then Ruweneko posed questions to him, and some of the allegations against him. One of them was that, what's the guy's name? Westwood?
Yeah, Paul, I think.
Paul Westwood.
DJ Westwood!
claims that Temba pushed him out of his company.
Noshio Motors, some 10 to 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is when this is meant to have happened.
Illegally so, and that he apparently threatened to kill him and threatened to rape his wife. And so Ruweneko tries to get Paul Westwood on the phone, and Temba says, "You're setting me up. Where is the other shareholder?" Because he claims that he bought the shares from the other shareholder who had 50% of the shares. And so he kicks up a storm and says, "I refuse to be set up. Capitalk is a captured institution."
Captured by Super.
Captured by Super and captured by Ozias Bute. And he refused to answer the questions. He refused to speak to Paul Westwood. And there was a, back and forth, and then they went to a break, and then I stopped watching after that because I saw that it had deteriorated to the point where it was.
She had lost control of the interview.
Yeah, it really wasn't. We weren't going to get anything serious out of it. First, I'll say that I don't believe that CapTalk is a captured institution.
Do you believe that Rueneck was a captured individual?
I don't think she's a captured individual. I think she thrives on certain level of controversy. I mean, those sort of things are, you know, they go viral and they can be very, they make for good TV. Let me say this. They make for good
TV. I don't think that was her intention,
you know, for it to deteriorate to that level, but I do think, you know, for it to be quote unquote hard hitting was something that was intended.
From a journalistic ethics point of view, from an ethical point of view,
yep,
as a journalist yourself,
yep,
is it ethical to ambush someone in that way?
It's not. So if you're going to have someone on, usually there's prep before. And either you or the producer says, well, we're going to discuss these talking points, A, B, and C. You don't have to, you know, give them questions in advance, but you at least inform them of what it is that you expect out of them. And then if you're going to have any other guests on the show, it is also courtesy and proper to inform them that we will also be joined by X, Y, and Z, so that they are prepared for it. You don't have to say.
How is that any different from when a member of the public calls in? So let's say I am Paul Westwood in this scenario, and I call into the radio station.
Yes.
Like he did.
Yes, but Paul Westwood.
And she picks up the phone and she says, "Hey, caller, how can I take your question?" No, and then now, he says, "I am Paul Westwood Temba."
Yes, but now it was it. If we go back to the tweet, she posted a tweet where she posted the number. And it's one of those situations where you're expecting somebody to call.
Yeah.
With the intention of that person being on the show, right? If it's a random caller, you know, the guest knows that sometimes the guest will know that this show takes calls from the public, which is fine, right? But if it is somebody who is involved in the matter, then that's completely different. Especially when the number was put out there, because she put it on Twitter, which I'm assuming was the intention for him to call in.
Yeah.
So it's just about informing you. Now, the thing is, if she had told him before, listen, we're going to be speaking to Paul Westwood, and he had said to her, well, I also want the other shareholder, and this had been done... Before, then, and they'd agreed to it, then there'd have been, you know, none of this situation happening. But if the way that it went down makes it look like it was set up.
Yeah, no, I think I listened to the interview myself, and she did lose control at some points, but I don't think it was terrible. To be fair, I think. I think Honorable Melissa was always going to be a difficult guest to have on, particularly if you are trying to get something out of him. But she's done this before, and at some point we're just going to have to accept that's her interviewing style, and that's just what's going to happen when she has bigger characters. She gets over.
I think it's one of those situations where certain people are going to make it difficult for their own gain. I mean, if you kick up a storm and you know throw the toys out the cot and all of that, you can make it look like you were put in a very hostile situation. I don't think it was a hostile situation. Temba simply had to say, "I don't want to talk to this person or get this other person on the phone," which he did.
But talking about Amber, because he had been constantly saying, "I'm not going to answer any questions from AC," because she kept trying to ask questions from AC on Facebook.
Yeah.
And he just said, "I'm not answering those questions."
Yeah, I mean, again, it's. I don't think she had to. I think she could have asked certain questions without saying where those questions were coming from, first and foremost. Like, especially with regards to some of the questions that AC was asking. And AC said, well, I have a right to reply, which he does to some of the things. But that can be done on a different platform, again. And I just...
But AC was just strategic marketing for his own show, which is now, get this, at ZFM, right. Which is owned by who? Super.
The plot thing.
And who had been accusing... the plot and this also done. Can bring back into the leak audio that implicated James Makamba, who was trying to get rid of who? Super.
Yeah, let's.
And now, miraculously, AC Lumumba has a show at ZFM.
Let's speak about that a little bit. So AC Lumumba started his show yesterday, and there was a media blackout in the Politics and Beyond group. Nobody actually listened to it. I don't know.
People are so salty. Yeah, on Musa, people don't do that. It's okay to listen to AC's show. Look, I know some people, it's like watching the Kardashians, it's fine. It's like, you know what it's like? It's like watching a train crash or a car crash, right? You know it's ugly, but you can't look away.
Like, legitimately, there was a media blackout in the Politics and Beyond group, and nobody spoke about it. We still don't know what was discussed. Nomaliso did try to, you know, to get us to listen to it, and nobody would bite. But, yeah, so he has a show on ZFM, and it's very interesting. Apparently, it's a sponsored show. I said sponsored by Super. But it seems to be a reward of some sort. That's what I'll call it. Because the leak did happen with the James Makamba leak did happen, and he is the one who leaked it.
And then the constant attacks on Temba, who's been attacking Super.
Yeah, it's clear that AC has picked a side, and the side that he's picked is Super's side. How that works out for both of them, we shall see, because, you know, AC can't be trusted. That's, you know, anyone who's ever dealt with him
AC
in any capacity will tell you that AC can't be trusted. So
yeah. AC will tell you he can't be trusted himself. I like that honesty.
That's true. I mean, he'll also throw you under the bus.
Yeah. So anyway.
So yeah, it should be interesting.
That's what's happening in Temba's world. We didn't really go into the actual corruption allegations that he's going. And I think maybe we'll have a full episode on corruption. We've promised a lot of episodes, but I think the corruption, particularly this NASA issue, deserves its own deep dive into it.
We should
quite convoluted. It involves, you know, Robin Vela, who's since been retired or fired. It involves, look, guys, you can't make this up. You know, it reads like a movie. It involves Temba Mlisa's ex-wife, who is the secretary, the legal secretary at NASA. Look, it's a lot. So
for me as well, I was the minister at the time.
Yeah, so it involves everyone. I think perhaps that would need its own episode with a diagram highlighting, you know, those police ones where they put the lines between
a flow chart.
Would you show you that Zimbabwe politics is basically just one big massive orgy of consumption? Wow. and patronage.
Yeah, no, we're in a messy situation, and it's going to take a lot more than a change of government to get rid of some of the issues that we're facing. And this is, you know, regardless of whether it's ZANU-PF or MDC, it's going to take a lot from everyone. There's going to be, you know, sacrifice. There needs to be a lot of sacrifice on both sides.
Yeah, they do. Speaking about both sides, we can use that as a segue to get into a wombology of the day. Comrades, comments made by Nelson Chamisa at the commemoration of the Workers' Day held by the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, where he was invited as guest of honor as the head of the legitimate MDC.
As the head of the MDC T1.
There's only one.
MDC T1, MDC T2.
If you want to talk about others, you can talk to yourself. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, so he said he came out with some highly controversial comments that were xenophobic. He said,
"You see, we've never been a podcast that plays clips. I was tempted to play the clip, but let's talk about it.
I can play. Well, do you have it? Send it to me, and I can play it.
Yeah, I'll send it to you now. I put it up on the group. I just didn't have it ready. Yeah, I've got it here. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, sure. Send it to my. I can't see it. Okay, there we go. Okay, it's come through. And here we go. Let's see.
But as Anguena Zongoti, Zimbabwe is open for business but closed for workers. Inso Atingoti, Zimbabwe is open for business. Tokukunza open for business, Ray. Turn out your business is looting. Turn out your business is corruption. Turn out your business is marginalization. Turn out your business is shit dealing. Nagaona Matira Kikwanangwena Nana China Nana. They are busy asset stripping my resources and yika. Donagan Tanga Mura September Dawako. Nibu Zamajana, we have Bano, it take you. So I say nice. Jokerakumba, Matiti. So I say nice, Jokerakumba, Matiti.
And there he goes.
There's problematic state called comments there. I mean, from the first line, kana uri murungu unza mari yako. You know, it's my pan-Africanist woke brothers and sisters would let you know that not only Warungu, there's not only Warungu anymore.
Yep.
But I think also, you know, Pachivanu, Pavenikulaga, Chero Dangota Rapinda Murum Junda Murungu Shamar Muruse. In fact, you guys, Munumadoro, Kana Nagautinga beer, we don't need to Omurungu.
Listen, I completely understand where you're coming from with that sentiment. However, I think the big issue with Chamisa is a lot of the things he's trying to say, he's just simply saying them wrong. And even with this Chinese comment, obviously people are going to say, you know, he's xenophobic, and why would you say that to the Chinese, who are huge investors across Africa right now? You don't want to piss them off because, you know, these bullet trains that he's talking about, who's building them in Kenya? It's Vasi Varungu, you know, it's the Chinese who are doing so. You know, so many infrastructure projects across the continent and across the world, actually. I mean, if we talk about the China Belt, what do they call it? The China Belt and Road Initiative. And this goes
across,
you know, it's $900 billion worth of investment, One Belt, One Road Initiative that goes across Asia, Africa, Eurasia, and Africa. So they really are, actually it's exceeding $3 trillion. So they really are putting so much...
$3 trillion, not my better check. Please, guys, yes. $3 trillion.
dollars.
Not my better checks.
You know, and this this is something that you'd want to get involved with. And I completely understand where he's saying, you know, he's talking about asset stripping, he's talking about bad deals, you know. But for him to express it in that way is wrong. Rather say, and this is, you know, pulling out of a Trump, is we're going to renegotiate the bad deals, which is fine, which you can do. So you can say that ZANU-PF has negotiated bad deals, and what we're going to do is renegotiate bad deals or renegotiate our position so that it's not asset stripping, so that we're also benefiting from it. But to come out and express it in that way is populist and it's reckless.
Yeah, no, he's definitely a populist in that way. I think we had the benefit of playing, and I suppose our listeners will have the benefit of having listened to that clip before speaking about it. How it's been reported is that without the context of asset stripping, without the context of bad deals. And I don't think that's necessarily unfair on the reporters. I think, I mean, the BBC should know better than picking up a story from the Herald, to be fair. But look, it's just, it is what it is. And if he doesn't wisen up on how mass media and mass communication works, he's going to continue falling in this hole. You know, I mean, some of us really are tired of constantly having to play clips for context, because any politician worth his salt, his weight in salt, in this day and age, really needs to be a master manipulator of the media. And that's the thing, is Chamisa is really good at manipulating crowds when they're there, but he's quite poor at manipulating media. And like, you use the Trump example, and what Trump did well was manipulating media, because even when the media was against him, they, you know, were ignoring what was happening on the ground. And to harness that level of energy, you need to be very disciplined in your message, because for all his rambling, Trump is quite disciplined on his message. Every single speech he does to this day is like the greatest hits. We'll build the wall, we'll get rid of, you know, certain migrants, we'll so. And that's just, you know, I suppose you're the one doing political communication, you can tell me more about it, you know, as your masters. But I really think that he just needs to get his greatest hits out there and just repeat them over and over again. This going off script thing is just crazy.
You see, the thing is, with the difference is, Trump was, you know, deliberately controversial, whereas I don't think that's the approach that Chamisa is going with, because he doesn't need to be. Trump was targeting a certain sector of society. You know, he was going all the way right. He wasn't interested in bridging the gap in between different sides. He had picked a side and he was focused on that side, and his messaging was targeted around those individuals. Where I believe Chamisa is in a different position altogether. He's working against a government that is perceived, that has been failing and is perceived to have been doing so. So he has that advantage. His communication should be inclusive, and it should also be inclusive of the capital that he is trying to attract as he goes forward. And it should be communication that shows direction. So one of the failings of ZANU-PF has been a lack of policy direction and a lack of policy implementation. When you give, and there's nothing wrong with dreaming, but when you give, you know, pie in the sky dreams, and when you say things that then don't correspond with what it is you're trying to achieve, people will not take you seriously. And next week he's going to be, you know, he's going to be in the UK. He's going to speak at Oxford, I think, and then he's going to speak at Chatham House as well. And I'm sure a lot of these questions are going to come up in, you know, regarding some of the comments that he's made, especially when it comes to the timelines and implementation. And I hope he has better answers there than he does here, because you don't want to, I mean, ZANU-PF has gone on a world tour to, or Mnangagwa and SP and all these people have gone on a world tour to position their image as reformists, as people who are willing to bring capital in and make sure that capital is safe and that, you know, it is going to grow in this new Zimbabwe, quote unquote. For Chamisa, yes, it's great to, you know, say that, you know, Warungu, for, I suppose he believes it's great to say Warungu come in, which is no different from what, from Zimbabwe's open for business, as far as I'm concerned. But you also want people to feel secure and their capital secure. And if you're going to be reneging on deals that any previous government made or just, you know, throwing them out, then people are not going to feel secure about that. And that's bad messaging. That is going to make a lot of investors very nervous, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Particularly with the nature of capital. Capital is the only thing that really doesn't care about race or creed or color or country. Right. So as many as you might be thinking you're appealing to Western backers, those Western backers are backed by Chinese money most likely. So whatever you're doing, you're missing out.
And also, speaking reckless, your father must come right. Your father must come right. How can he say? So I don't know. I don't know if we spoke about the marijuana issue. Yes, we did.
We did not today.
No, last week. Didn't we speak about legalizing it?
I don't know. Anyway, look.
Anyway, yeah. So your father came out and said and said that a kilo of marijuana has a street value of $1 million in New York and London. Where is he buying his weed? Because he clearly, for him to say such a statement, he clearly was on it, right? He was clearly high. Now I want to know, $1 million, where is he buying his weed for that much? Because I think we could find a jazz man back home who can give him a better rate than what he's getting right now.
A better rate. That guy. Man, I mean, look, I don't know what happens when you get to start traveling business class and living in the, staying in the Marriott when you're in New York. But personally, I mean, you know, I'm in one of the most expensive cities in the world. I've never seen marijuana for $1 million per kilo. I don't know. Maybe he's smoking $1 million weed. That's why he was. But
that's why he goes off on his dirigism tangents.
Dirigism. Okay. Talking about tangents, have you heard that that Mswangwa comment that got all of you guys, all of the media in Zimbabwe confused? People were quoting him saying revengist tendencies. When he was in his interview talking about his loss in Norton, he is quoted as having said, "I was defeated by revengist cabals or something, something similar to that." When he actually meant revanchist, or he was talking about revanchist, and revanchism is a political manifestation of the will to reverse territorial losses incurred by a country, a war, or a social movement. Wow, it's actually a school of political thought on its own. So I think when it comes to big words, there's a certain level of high grade that you need to be smoking.
It's a certain level of aristocrat who likes to delve into.
What a segue.
who likes to brandish such big words? Because I'm pretty sure
those are the type of people that aristocrats would want to vote for.
Those are the type of people who believe in aristocracy, I think.
You know, when I was actually, you can go ahead and give a quick definition. I'm actually posting up the link on on Twitter now of that article, but you can give a quick definition of what epistocracy is.
So just let me pull it up. Essentially what it is it's ruled by citizens with political knowledge. So whereas democracy is ruled by the majority, where, you know, the people vote and they, you know, rule with it, or they vote for the people they want to govern them. Epistocracy believes that those who are knowledgeable in political matters should be the ones to make the decisions. Essentially, people are, or knowledge-based voting. So the idea is that people have no idea what they're voting on or voting for. If you take the example of Brexit, where people were then Googling what is Brexit or what does Brexit mean post the election, when, you know, everything had gone to shit, there was a belief that, well, people clearly don't know what they're doing, so only those who are knowledgeable on what Brexit was should have been allowed to vote. And that's essentially what it is.
So there's an article which is in The Guardian and is an excerpt from a book by this guy David Runciman. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And it does speak about, you know, I suppose about why it's bad, about why epistocracy wouldn't work. For me, the things that I really took out of it was when you say epistocracy, it seems quite evident. It almost seems obvious. Like, there's a way to say it without really thinking of its consequences. Which, oh, no, don't you think everyone who votes or everyone who controls the electoral system should be well informed? Of course, most people will say yes to that. But without really thinking about what that actually means, like, or what that means. And the first thing is that it's different from a technocracy where technocrats rule, because technocrats are already playing a part in the democracy right now. So they're not necessarily a new system. They'll just be a part of the...
The idea was that, you know, technocrats are generally implementers of policy but not designers of it, if that makes sense. So they know how systems should run, and that's what they're in there to do, to run systems, but not necessarily to come up with the best system for people to, or the best way for people to live.
Yeah, so I mean, look, you can correct me if I'm just trying to...
I mean, what's your position? So we all agree that it is being informed or making informed decisions is a better way, I think. I don't think... I generally don't think that people should make decisions without understanding the implications of some of their decisions. And I think, unfortunately, however, that is almost impossible in a lot of instances, because a lot of the time people vote on emotion as well.
Yeah, and I'm moved by emotion. I think for me, I think the argument for epistocracy is in sort of restricting how many people can vote or who exercises political power in a democracy based on some basic knowledge test, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. And in fact, why I don't think that's not necessarily a good thing is something that he didn't really mention, is that in most mature democracies anyway, political power is wielded by a select few anyway, as it is. Any of the choices that happen, any of the ideas that are put forward are really quite narrow, particularly economically, are quite narrow, within a narrow band of what's accepted. And most of these populist thinkers, or whether they're on the left or on the right, you know, somehow subscribe to the neoliberal, like, you know, ideologies. And you can't really, especially in places like Australia or England or, you know, to a lesser extent America, you can't really put a piece of paper between their economic ideologies at the very core of them. So it seems a bit redundant to then want to argue about it, because as I see it, it's already in a situation where, you know, the masses are really controlled by the organized few.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's this conversation is coming up based on this rise in populism, Trump, and Trump and Brexit, and this, you know, rise in nationalism that's happening. And it is the left that feels that, you know, they're hard done by. But I think these are anomalies, and the system itself will self-correct at some point, where people people generally are either right or left of the center. You know, they don't fluctuate to the far or to the far right or far left. Hardly ever. When they do, the system itself, the system corrects itself. The problem with, you know, epistocracy is how do you measure what political knowledge people has? What sort of test do you give? Another system said that there should be a tier, you know, where the highly educated doctors, lawyers and the such have their votes are worth 6, and then you go down 5, 4, and then the lowest individual with no education, his vote is only worth 1. But again, you know, how do you separate the different bands? How do you decide which profession is more knowledgeable about different situations? It's a very elitist way of thinking.
But it's I mean, I went to read then the beginning.
Yeah.
It can be a compelling argument, I suppose, maybe because in terms of education, doing a master's, it automatically puts you in that sector where you would expect to have more votes. But do you think that it's fair that we should be, or people, anyone should be at the mercy of the decisions made by someone who's uneducated or who is ignorant of certain things? So how come in an election, in a democracy, where we're being put at the mercy of incompetent or unreasonable people? That's the argument for epistocracy.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of people are stupid, a lot of people are dumb, a lot of people are ignorant of politics.
Yes.
Why should the smart people in the smart people be at the mercy of those dumb people? If you went to a doctor, you wouldn't go to a doctor that doesn't know what he's doing.
That is
true. It would be, in fact, to be immoral for you to get into a combi and be driven. I suppose, never mind, combi is a bad example because some combi drivers don't have licenses. Look, but
do you know who speaks this way?
Do
you know who speaks this way? Which Zimbabwean politician speaks this way?
Who?
Nkosana Moyo.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're essentially making his argument that, you know, you should be qualified for the job.
But you know what's funny?
Yeah.
Like, that's Ngosana is one way who speaks that way. But if you actually look at the... no, never mind. At the idea of a national transitional authority. After that Ibo Manda's opposed and Tendai's idea of an NTA.
Yeah.
It's essentially advocated for the philosopher rulers.
Again, now this is where, you know, the what makes those people know best for certain people is the question, because it comes down to so for example, the colonial argument, right, was that we are modernizing and we are bringing, you know, we are bringing you out of the dark ages, right? But why is what you are doing best for me? How do you know that what you are doing is best for me? So it goes both ways. Don't you want someone to represent you who understands where you are from and what your needs are? Why are you assuming that because you went to X school and you got X degrees that you know that I should live my life in this way, or this is the best way to live my life? It's a compelling argument, but I think there's a counter argument that is also, you know, quite interesting and quite compelling, especially within the context. So now when we're bringing it to the context of African countries and where we've come from and having all these systems imposed on African people that then go on to marginalize and oppress them, is an epistocracy, especially one where you have, you know, this huge gap between the haves and the have-nots and the, you know, the elites within a society or within a country like Zimbabwe. Is it the best way to go? Who, overall, who benefits from it?
Yeah, it's not, I mean, look, then comes down, guys, it's no longer about the knowledge, it's now about the actual power part of it. That's what he says in the article, is that it's in the exercise of power that it then has its risks. That as flawed as democracies are, you see, I chop English words too, are, they are best at avoiding the worst. They might not be able to pick out the best all the time, but they're the best at avoiding the worst. Whereas if we've seen, because the arguments against an elite class ruling are the same as you could use against, at least in my opinion, to on a larger scale, is using against like an authoritative dictator or whatever, are the same. That once they, a benevolent dictator is good until they start making the wrong decisions. And once they make the wrong decisions, everyone suffers. And whereas a democracy might not be able to make the right decisions all the time, they avoid the pitfalls of when a ruler, an absolute ruler, is making the worst decisions. And that's the same thing here, is that, you know, if a ruling elite is making the right decisions, that's great. But when they start making the wrong decisions, there's no one to tell them that they're making the wrong decisions.
Yep. Essentially, yes.
No, and so, I mean, look, it's an interesting thing, because a lot of the conversations going on in Zim now, particularly with, like, if you try to bring it to the context of all these independence and all these things, and then, you know, even talking about China, and there's definitely an undercurrent of people who are looking maybe for an alternative governance system. Like, you know, that's why things like GNUs and those kind of conversations keep coming up, is that at some point people sort of acknowledge that maybe the system we have isn't the best system for us.
Yeah.
Or there's something that needs to be done about the system to make it more efficient. And, you know, I guess this is an alternative, but Ameno.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, I think we spoke about this last week when we were speaking about Professor's article, is that these are some of the things that really do need to be, you know, it needs not pedestrian thinkers like us, but it needs actual individuals to sit down and contemplate these positions and these thoughts. We've been a democracy, quote-unquote, for 38 years now. And what have we achieved in those 38 years? Is there a better system for us? How do we negotiate this better system? It's worth a thought it's worth it to put these ideas out there and have, you know, vibrant discussions about them, because we do want the best for the country, and it's determining what that best is. Not all countries are democracies, are the, you know, China's thrived without being one over the past. Singapore sort of as well. So Rwanda on paper, yes, but in practice, you know, we can question that. So it is worth it to, I think, to relook some of these things. And again, when you look at what even modern democracies are doing, the UK, you know, they had two elections in the space. They had the referendum and then they had the election, and both of them didn't go the way that, you know, anyone expected or intended, and detrimentally so. So it's worth it to look at it and say, well, what's the best system for us, especially as we go towards this fourth industrial revolution, as we try to find space for ourselves in the world. And how we are going to...
We really do need to think about it. You know, we'll talk about it a lot later, but you should look at the Australian system, where it's compulsory voting. and is preferential and preferences. So it's not a majority. It's not an absolute majoritarian system. And it's also compulsory voting. So you have to preference your votes. So look, we can talk about it in detail. Let me just. So basically, when you guys go to vote, instead of putting an X on Chamisa's name, or an X on Emerson's name, you put a number one on Emerson, then a number two on Chamisa, then a number three, and everyone puts their preferences. So whoever has the most ones then becomes the leader. But how it works then is that if me and you have similar ones, but I have more twos, then I become the leader. Or if we don't win outright, but the twos win out, have more twos, then they become the member of parliament. So it's a preferential system. So if more people prefer you as second, you actually might win the election, as opposed to two candidates who split their one votes. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that sounds like a very interesting system. Even the issue of compulsory voting is interesting, which is also controversial in itself.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I mean, look, there's plenty of time to discuss that. Maybe if you guys enjoy these little segments, you can let us know. And if you have anything to say on or to add on them, you should also let us know. We're also just learning and. Yeah, you know, giving our pedestrian, we should call this segment the pedestrian view segment.
We should, actually. Next time we'll get philosopher Tatenda Mashanda on the program to unpack some of these things. He's one who enjoys
that. There's also another one who's very good.
We should
great addition to the group.
We should have a mini debate since. What do you call it? A start. We'll get some of our Neroists and our Scafists. No, I was going with that one. We'll get our Neroists and our Scafists on the program and see if you know.
You're going to go and say something.
I really was. I was going to be very upset if I had to say it. Anyway, thanks very much. This has been another great episode, quite a long one as well. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Politics and Beyond, Poly and Beyond ZW, respectively. Share your thoughts, share the episode. Thanks, guys.
All right, see you guys. Bye. And now.
Capital 263.